This is episode number 9 of the Falfa Project Podcast. When is law legitimate? 12 criteria for discerning. Welcome, I'm Mr. M. In previous episodes, we've talked about some general aspects of authority and about the primary functions of law. In today's episode, we consider the legitimacy of law and 12 specific criteria to that end. In other words, what makes a law legitimate or not? There is a sense in which things are only as legitimate as they are good. Think of a really awful teacher. You might call her a bad teacher. And if she didn't know the basic things that teachers in her field should know, you might think that she's not even a real teacher. You could replace teacher here with doctor or parent or just about any other profession or role. Imagine a substance which, at just the right dose, had the potential to save a patient, but at the wrong dose could easily kill him. If this patient were given this substance at the proper dosage, it would be medicine. But if he were given the wrong dosage, it would be poison. Even though in each case it is made up of exactly the same stuff, its functions become inverted. To call it medicine then would be erroneous, even if it appears to be so. You see, in this context, we define things according to their functions. So when something does not fulfill one of those essential functions, the very identity of that thing comes into question. This is applicable to many things, including the roles we take on and the very matter of law itself. And so we ask, what is a teacher? What is a doctor? Heck, what is a mango? What functions do they serve? And at what point are they no longer what they are claimed to be? Is a teacher who never teaches a teacher? Is a scientist who does not follow the scientific method a scientist? Is a mango made out of plastic really a mango? And the most paramount question for our purposes are, what is law? When is law so deficient in performing its functions that it is no longer a proper law at all? If we have correctly identified the essential functions of law, then we should be able to identify when law does not fulfill those functions and actually defies the very purpose and definition of law. And let me clarify that when I talk about law here, I mean law prescribed by the general governing body of a people. I do not mean law as in the general principles or laws of morality. Indeed, the official laws of a nation should properly reflect the general moral principles and laws. For example, a law condemning and punishing murder would reflect the moral principles that tell us that murder is wrong, and the additional moral principle that tells us that those who commit such serious moral violations should also face serious consequences for their actions. But they are not one and the same, because the law is in this case a specific application of a moral principles. But there are many other factors that could make such a law just or unjust, depending on the specific factors at play for those particular people under the law. In other words, every application is specific and dependent upon the people and situation it is meant to serve, while moral principles are general and apply to all men. Incidentally, there is a growing consensus now that capital punishment, that is, the death penalty, is no longer appropriate for our society at this point in time. This does not invalidate the moral principles behind such a law, but it underlines the fact that conditions have changed, and we no longer need put anybody to death to protect society at large. This is an example of how laws can change while their underlying moral principles do not. So when I say simply law in this episode, I do not mean moral law, which we should all keep regardless of the official law of the land. I mean specific laws passed by the governing authority considered official in the land. This brings us to our next point. In our last episode, we identified the functions of law as order and justice, justice being above order in terms of priorities. In the episodes before that, we discussed the need for authority in society and the fact that not all authority is legitimate, as well as the fact that not all laws are legitimate. When law is contrary to the eternal moral law, it becomes more like a kind of violence against man. At this point, several requirements for the legitimacy of law start to become apparent. In fact, we can thus begin to discern a number of criteria which are necessary for law to be legitimate. While these may well not be the only criteria necessary for the legitimacy of law, certainly no law can be legitimate if it does not meet at least these 12 criteria. And they are the following. 1. A law must fulfill its functions. 2. A law must not be contrary to moral principles. 3. A law must be prescribed by a legitimate governing authority. 4. A law must be knowable. 5. A law must be understandable. 6. A law must be specific. 7. A law must be practical to enforce and to determine when it has been broken. 8. A law must not contradict a higher law nor undermine its own foundation. 9. A law must not exceed the jurisdiction of the governing body or its legal foundation. 10. A law must be logical and grounded in reality. 11. A law must be necessary. And 12. A law must not be retroactive. Now, let's go over all of these one by one. Number 1. A law must fulfill its functions. Law must serve a function of order or justice or both, while always placing justice above order. For example, a law outlawing mango ice cream without intending to serve neither order nor justice would not be a legitimate law. It would simply be an arbitrary command. Now, if said law were passed because all mangoes had been contaminated and thus unsafe to eat, this might well be a legitimate law. Law must serve order or justice. If it does not, then it has no purpose or place as law, especially if it hampers my enjoyment of mango ice cream. Number 2. A law must not be contrary to moral principles. This is pretty self-explanatory. A law in opposition to moral principle is no law at all, for a law opposed to moral principles is unjust, defeating one of its primary purposes. In that sense, one might consider this criterion a subset of the prior. Both this and the prior criterion address the issue of proportionality. If a law correctly identifies an issue, but applies a disproportional penalty, then it is unjust. In the Old Testament, an eye for an eye was actually an improvement over the old law, which was wildly disproportionate. Today, we should aim rightly for proportionate responses to lawbreaking and ideally to corrective but merciful responses to lawbreaking, even in the case of horrible crimes such as murder. Number 3. A law must be prescribed by a legitimate governing authority. A law prescribed, even with the best of intentions, and even if not contrary to the moral law, by someone who does not have the authority to pass laws, is not a law. The question of what constitutes legitimate authority is a whole other topic unto itself, which would require at least another episode to even begin to consider. Suffice to say for now that it is a requirement for law, for pretty apparent reasons. Number 4. A law must be knowable. We hear a lot about secret courts, secret trials, and secret laws these days. These are not the things of a free society. Laws and the legal process must be knowable by all those who are bound by them. One cannot fulfill what one does not know. Secret laws may be applicable to those who know and subscribe to such laws, but they must not be applicable to those who are not aware of them. This has no place in a proper legal system. In many past and some current simpler societies, laws are not written, but are communicated orally. This in itself does not make law lack legitimacy. In fact, cultures with a rich oral tradition tend to know their own laws and customs better than those without a primarily oral tradition. What is important is that the law is knowable, and that this knowledge is easily accessible to those who are expected to observe such laws. In our society, the written word is required to make law official, therefore making it an additional criterion for the legitimacy of law. The text of the law, therefore, must be practically accessible by the citizen. If a law is written, passed, and kept locked in a vault or a memory storage device where the average citizen would be unable to access it, then it would not qualify as a legitimate law, for it is not knowable by most. Public law must be publicly known and knowable. The general text of the law has been easily accessible in our society for a long time through libraries and writing to government bodies. And now, much like all types of information, it has become even easier to access via the internet. Announcing a law is important, but not enough, because no announcement will reach everyone at the same time. So it is important that the text of the law is published in some way that is easy for citizens to access at any given time within the norms of that society. And for us, that means anytime, anywhere. Number 5. A law must be understandable. It follows that if a law must be knowable, then it must also be understandable. By understandable, I mean understandable to the average person with no more than some moderate examination. People cannot follow laws that they cannot understand. And if it is impossible to follow a law, then that law cannot be legitimate. It is true that this is subjective, but law itself is a subjective implementation of objective principles. This criterion takes prudence into account. This is one of the reasons that while principles are universals, laws must be specific to a certain people or region. Because different people and different nations have different levels of understanding, and some laws that might be appropriate for one may well not be appropriate for another. To pass a law requiring the reading of contracts by everyone, for example, in a highly illiterate society, is an illogical, unjust, and illegitimate law. Similarly, if the law is written in a highly technical language that is not understandable by most of the people who are supposed to adhere to it, then it cannot possibly be legitimate. This also applies to the interpretation of the law. If the honest interpretation of what is written in the law by the average citizen is significantly different from the interpretation of the law by the legal system, then that law is simply not understandable. To the citizen, it says one thing, and yet to the legal system, it says another. So practically speaking, it is not the same law. And law is a practical matter, which impacts every citizen on a daily basis. It is irrational and unconscionable to believe that citizens must follow laws that they cannot understand properly. It is either an error in the expression of the law, in which case it should be corrected promptly, or an error in the meaning of the law, in which case it should be repealed promptly. Now, some people believe that understanding law is naturally beyond the ability of the average citizen and requires a plethora of experts and scholars to discern. While it is true that law may be a specialization and may take considerable study to properly understand as a whole, in terms of underlying philosophies, case histories, and applicability, an individual law that applies to the general public should be understandable by all. If there is necessarily some legal complexity involved, then it must be explained in plain language completely and correctly by those whose job it is to interpret the law as such. One does not need to be a scientist to understand essential scientific concepts. I may not be able to carry out the scientific experimentation and process by which scientists discover the laws of nature, but I am capable of understanding the concepts when they are explained to me in plain language or so-called layman's terms. I understand the realities of germs, electricity, and radiation, and their practical implications without needing to understand the complex history, process, and terminology behind those discoveries. If we can understand even these scientific concepts, which are more complex than any legal theory, then what excuse does law have for not being understandable to the average citizen? This does put a responsibility on the citizen, however. Every citizen must seek to inform himself about and understand the law. Although there are a lot of laws, and this is to be expected in a large, complex, and multicultural society, there is no need to know all the laws at all times. There is only a need to know the laws which practically impact us at any given time in any given situation. For example, in daily life, it is important to know and understand only the general laws of one's nation, city, or state. Things like, what side of the road do we drive on, what taxes we are supposed to pay, and what rights and duties the law recognizes when we are faced with law enforcement officers. These are things which tend to be either obvious or obviously exist, so we know to inform ourselves about them. Now, if one were to open a restaurant, for instance, then one would know to inform oneself about the laws applicable to restaurants. If one were to buy a house, then one would know to inform oneself about laws pertaining to the purchase of a house. While many people do not take this responsibility seriously, many do either take the time to inform themselves directly or at least hire someone who can interpret for them and represent them. Now, the ability to hire a specialist, such as a lawyer, does not excuse the law of a requirement to be understandable. However, it is logical that when an expert is necessary, whether it be in the area of carpentry or in law, that one is better off hiring such an expert rather than attempting such a feat oneself without such expertise in dealing with an important matter. The point I am trying to make is that no one needs to know all the laws at all times for law to be legitimate. Indeed, law can be both complex and legitimate. However, it does need to be understandable and accessible by all who are bound by it. Likewise, citizens have a duty to properly inform themselves or otherwise deal with the law as far as this is feasible. If understanding and informing one's self about the law of the land, at least where one's own situation is concerned, is practically unfeasible for the average citizen, then such laws start to lose their legitimacy. For laws that are not understandable or accessible cannot be legitimate. This also relates to the fact that laws must be knowable to be legitimate. Now, what about the citizen who truly does not possess normal capacity to understand the law? This might be the case of a legitimate but not average citizen. Is this citizen then exempt from the law due to his inability to understand it? Let's consider the case of children. They may be citizens, and yet due to their age, they may not be capable of completely understanding the law. So, with children, we are gentle and prudent, and have someone capable of understanding the law take care of them and respond for them. The law still applies to them, but it is their parents or guardians who are responsible for having them adhere to it. The case is similar with an adult citizen who is also incapable of understanding the law. But the exception does not invalidate the rule. The law must still be understandable by most if it is to be legitimate. Number 6. A law must be specific. Laws can usually be reformulated as if-then statements. Let me explain. A law will usually declare what action must be taken or not taken, followed by what actions the governing body will take depending upon the first. So, for example, if first-degree murder is committed, then the government will imprison the murderer for life. This is an example of a specific law. However, if either the first condition or the subsequent action is not well defined, a law might as well say almost anything. Imagine a law that said, if a citizen kills another, the government will take serious action. The problem here is that neither the condition nor the action is well defined. For example, what kind of killing? Is it murder? Is it manslaughter? Or does it also include killing in self-defense? Additionally, what action is considered serious, and who specifically will decide and administer the penalty? A judge? A jury? A special body? The problem is that this law would be so broad that it could be applied to too many different kinds of cases without any specific penalty or process. This type of law becomes arbitrary, almost like a blank check for authorities to do anything they please in a very broadly defined situation. This contradicts the very purpose of law. It would then be a simple matter to write just a few handful of laws that would cover about any conceivable situation under the sun and allow for just about any conceivable penalty without any recourse. This is a favorite strategy of oppressive governments. Such so-called laws are defined so broadly that authorities can simply do as they please anytime, anywhere, to anyone. This is not law. This is totalitarianism under the guise of law. Now, the mere presence of such an aberration does not automatically constitute that the governing body is a totalitarian one. Sometimes laws are just badly written, in which case they need to be revised because such broad laws ultimately have no legitimacy. A law that allows for anything is one that is worth nothing. Number 7. A law must be practical to enforce and to determine when it has been broken. Following the paradigm of the if-then statement, one can see that a determination is necessary in the if part, while enforcement is necessary in the then part, whether it is spelled out in the particular law itself or in the general code of law. For example, let's say the law says the following. If an individual commits petty theft, then he must pay a $500 fine. In this case, there must be some possible and practical way of determining whether or not an individual has committed petty theft. In many cases, people do get away with petty theft, so there is no foolproof method. However, many people are caught committing petty theft. Therefore, there are possible and practical and ethical ways of determining said condition. As for the penalty, this assumes that there is a governing body in place that has the means and will to collect this fine from individuals who commit such a crime. Following this assumption, this law is both practical to enforce and there is a practical way to determine when it has been broken. Now, let us imagine the following law. If an individual intends to harm another because of his race, he must face additional penalties prescribed by the court. This is what we would call a hate crime. The first problem with this sort of law is that it tries to make a determination that is rather difficult and impractical to make in many cases. When someone harms another, there may be a myriad of reasons, and both personal and ideological reasons may be at play in the perpetrator's mind. Another problem is that one wonders why the perpetrator's personal prejudice is on trial at all. Racism is ugly and sinful, but in itself is just that. Though the law should recognize man's spiritual nature, it should not penalize sin directly, but rather actions that are objectively wrong, as long as they were intended. If harm is intended, and that can be reliably proven, then that is enough to condemn and penalize a man. It is unnecessary and outside the scope of the law to punish a man further for what type of twisted reasons he had to maliciously inflict harm upon another. But I digress. My main point is simply that some types of conditions are difficult, impractical, or nearly impossible to determine reliably, and thus cannot be considered determinable. If authorities cannot even determine whether or not the law has been broken in most cases, then it cannot be applied. What legitimacy can an ineffective law have? None. Even worse, if a false method of determination is used, such a law could be used to unjustly convict innocent people. One has only to look toward the Salem witch trials for a prime example of this. Alternatively, if the law were properly determinable, but authorities had no way to enforce the law, then it would be ineffective as well. A law which does nothing is no law at all. Laws are prescriptions, not merely descriptions. They are meant to be enforced, not merely written. If a law cannot be enforced, then it has lost its power and thus its legitimacy. Such laws do nothing but fill up the law books, wasting time and other resources. This is different from laws which are seldom enforced because they are seldom violated, or have even never been enforced because they have never been violated. One can imagine a law against the use of a small nuclear weapon in a city that perhaps has never been violated and hopefully never will be, but is nonetheless a perfectly legitimate law. The condition can be reliably determined, and the authorities can properly enforce it. What I am referring to is laws that cannot possibly or practically be determined or enforced. These have no business being laws, for they are effete. Number 8. A law must not contradict a higher law, nor undermine its own foundation. For example, an American law cannot contradict the U.S. Constitution, both because the Constitution is its foundation, and because it is indeed a higher law. Similarly, a city law cannot contradict a state law, and a state law cannot contradict a federal law, unless that federal law is not legitimate. Of course, if two laws at the same legal level contradict each other, at least one of them is not legitimate. However, the very fact that they contradict does not automatically make them both illegitimate, because one of them may well be proper law. But a law can never be legitimate in any legal framework if it contradicts a law higher than itself. If we assume for a moment that this could be possible, and that such a law were actually legitimate, then that would make the higher law illegitimate, thus eroding its very foundation, and calling into question the very legitimacy of the entire legal system and governing authority, which, if not legitimate, would automatically make all of its laws illegitimate as well. At the very least, such a law could not be legitimate unless and until the higher law it contradicted was revised so that it would no longer be contradictory. One could frame this as a matter of impossible contradiction, or as a matter of the undermining of its very authority and foundation. Even if the Communist Party won a primary election, they would not be able to legally change the American system to a communist one, because the foundation of our system is antithetical to the communist system. Those in power might be able to trick people into thinking that they had changed the law of the land legally, but in reality, it would all be illegal, even if under the guise of legitimate authority and law. In other words, a law can't undermine the very foundation that it's based on, for it would no longer have any foundation to stand at all, and thus, it would have no legitimacy. Such a thing is self-refuting. Number 9. A law must not exceed the jurisdiction of the governing body or its legal foundation. Simply stated, a law cannot exceed the jurisdiction of the government. We touched on this very subject in our last episode. Government simply does not have the right to govern all aspects of our lives. Government has a right and duty to govern within a range of matters. It has no right to dictate how we should live our lives. While a law may be written which is not explicitly contrary to its foundation, the U.S. Constitution, in our case, it may still overstep the bounds of its authority. All legitimate governing bodies have a limited range of matters which they are tasked with legislating. In fact, in the case of Americans, our Constitution explicitly limits government power. The government may not legislate beyond those powers which it has been granted via the Constitution. The Bill of Rights was created to explicitly spell out rights the government cannot violate, but it is not an exhaustive list. In fact, it specifically gives any other powers to the states or individuals, rather than allowing them to the federal government. These inconvenient facts have been tragically ignored, however. The authorities are simply not within their rights to tell us to eat our veggies or not to eat too many sweets. They cannot justly force us to wear our seatbelts or not to watch too much television. This is called paternalism because it places the government in the role of a parent who monitors and disciplines his child for his child's best interest. The key difference here is that parents do have a moral right and responsibility to monitor and discipline their children for their own sake. Governments, however, do not have such a right nor responsibility. The primary purpose for disciplining a child is so that the child can become a healthy, spiritually aware adult that can go about his business in life without the continuing aid of a parent and then possibly raise his own children. It is not so that adults can be passed off to the government as some kind of adult children for the government to take care of cradle to grave. Such laws simply overstep the bounds of government, no matter how many in society wish such a government themselves. If the citizens of a nation wish to be enslaved, should they be allowed such enslavement? Should they be able to impose such a thing on others by majority rule? No, absolutely not. Otherwise, rights wouldn't be rights, but simply a mere social contract, which I have never signed, nor consented to, nor could, even if I wanted to. Some people confuse something that is good to do with something we should be forced to do. I agree that wearing my seatbelt is something good to do, but I vehemently disagree that I should be forced to do it. In fact, I do it in spite of such illegitimate laws. This criterion also ties into the idea of subsidiarity. The Catechism defines this nicely. It says, "In accordance with the principle of subsidiarity, neither the state nor any larger society should substitute itself for the initiative and responsibility of individuals and intermediary bodies." In other words, the state should not substitute the role or responsibility of the local community, parents, or the individual. These rights and responsibilities belong properly to them, not to the state. Number 10. A law must be logical and grounded in reality. In logic, we can use a syllogism to determine whether any particular proposition is logical or not. We do this by testing two or more premises against one another and determining whether the purported conclusion is actually valid. For example, consider the following sentences. All crimes should be penalized. Torture is a crime. Therefore, torture should be penalized. The first and second sentences are premises. Premise 1 is that all crimes should be penalized. Premise 2 is that torture is a crime. And the conclusion is that torture should be penalized. The sequence here is A equals B and C equals A, therefore C equals B. I think it is plain to see that this conclusion is indeed logically valid. This simple tool is very powerful for determining whether a proposition is logical or not. Had the conclusion been different, for example, that torture is not a crime, then we would have realized that this proposition was not logical. Exactly this kind of nonsense has taken place in our own government, where it is admitted that torture is a crime and that torture has taken place on behalf of the government but the government refused to admit that it had committed a crime. And yet, no other conclusion was possible, whether it was explicitly stated or not. Laws must be logically valid. We must test their premises and conclusion in order to determine their logical validity. Sometimes it can be difficult to tease out these premises and conclusion, but they exist in every law, even if they are not explicitly stated. We can reuse one of the previous examples, which is, if an individual commits petty theft, then he must pay a $500 fine. What are the premises and the conclusion here? We have several ways in which we could formulate the syllogism. Let's try this one. Premise 1, petty theft is a crime. Premise 2, all crimes should be penalized. Premise 3, penalties should be proportional to the crime. Premise 4, a fine of $500 is proportional to the crime of petty theft. Conclusion, therefore, petty theft should be penalized with a $500 fine. If the logic is sound, then the conclusion is valid. But we might argue whether a $500 fine is truly proportional to the crime of petty theft, or whether all crimes really should be penalized. So, although the conclusion is logically valid, we may still question the truth of the premises themselves. Let's try a more dramatic example. Premise 1. All people have the right to engage in consensual sexual relations. Premise 2. Children are people. Conclusion. Therefore, children have the right to engage in consensual sexual relations. Here, the logic is right, but premise 1 is wrong. The premise is wrong because it is not grounded in reality. All people do not have the right to engage in consensual sexual relations because all people do not have the ability to consent. Children and some mentally handicapped people do not have the ability to consent to sexual relations, so they cannot possibly have the right to do what they cannot consent to doing. Therefore, it is untrue that all people have the right to engage in consensual sexual relations. I think we can all agree that laws should be logically valid and grounded in reality. Otherwise, we might wind up erroneously discerning various rights and responsibilities which are not grounded in truth. Such laws cannot possibly have any legitimacy, since they are not logically sound or pertain to a world that is not our own. Number 11. A law must be necessary. Let us remember that law is force. If one does not comply with the law is enforced by some means, including economical force that can ruin an individual's livelihood, or physical force that can mean imprisonment, or worse. To this we can add the emotional and psychological cost of being on the wrong side of the law. My point is simply that laws are not meant to be taken lightly, and they should not be passed without good reason. In fact, the burden of proof that a law is necessary depends on those proposing and supporting said law. Some people seem to believe that laws are the solution to every problem, without considering all of the possible consequences. Laws are not meant to address every frustration and inconvenience in life. They are not even meant to address every injustice. Some injustices are small and better dealt with outside of the law on a personal and communal level. Imagine if every brotherly dispute needed to be determined by some law. Every law demands some amount of funds, manpower, and other resources directly or indirectly. Public funds are not meant to be used and increased for matters that could easily be dealt with on a smaller, more efficient, more personal level. It is a misuse of public funds and the legal system to have law address frivolous matters. It is a sad testament to the misunderstanding and disregard for our public funds and the use of our legal system that those politicians that help pass unnecessary but popular laws are celebrated. And yet those who reject such improper and unethical use of funds and law are often penalized for their righteousness in this regard by not being politically supported. There was a certain Texas congressman who opposed unnecessary laws and government action. And this is rather unusual, which is why, as he was also a medical doctor, he earned the nickname Dr. No. we should have more Dr. No-type politicians. To illustrate the immorality and violence of an unnecessary law, since we are talking about doctors, imagine your doctor telling you, "You don't really need this medicine, but you have to take it anyway." Utilizing force without a moral reason is unreasonable and unjust. It is just might makes right under the guise of democracy and legitimate authority. No unnecessary law has any legitimacy. Law must be necessary if it is to be legitimate. The legal system is not optional, and therefore neither are laws. Those who use and support the use of force have the moral burden of proof to demonstrate that their proposed use of force, which comes with any law, is moral and justified. There is no room in a proper legal system for laws that are not necessary. Lastly, but not least, number 12. A law must not be retroactive. No legitimate law can be retroactive. This means that the consequences of passing a law can only be applied to those things that happen after its passing, not those things that have already taken place. For example, if abortions were made illegal in the United States today, with serious consequences for doctors who performed such acts, the law could not punish those doctors who had already performed abortions before the new law was passed and took effect. Similarly, slave owners before slavery was declared illegal could not be prosecuted for having owned slaves, because it was perfectly consistent with the law before, even if such a law never really had any legitimacy to begin with, because it violated moral law. Nevertheless, it would completely disrupt order and perhaps justice if laws were made retroactive. One could never know what crime one could be prosecuted with in the future, even if one always followed the law of the land at the time. It would be chaos, and contrary to the very nature of law. One can easily see why such a law would not be legitimate. Additionally, it would be illogical for a law to have power before it came into existence, nor after it ceased to exist, which is also why authorities must stop enforcing the penalty of law when that law has ceased to exist. Those who are imprisoned for violating a law no longer in effect, for example, must be freed, for no one is bound by a repealed law. Conclusion. These 12 criteria are not necessarily all the criteria there are for determining whether a law is legitimate or not. But certainly, I think they are a good starting point. We must use critical thinking and careful discernment to come to genuine conclusions about the legitimacy of current and proposed laws. In a future episode, we will consider what can be done about illegitimate laws. And I hope that you have found this episode legitimately worthwhile. In our next episode, we'll be having our first interview, so stay tuned. And thank you for listening to this lengthy episode of the FALFA Project Podcast. You can view references and notes for this episode at falfaproject.org/episode9. That's all lowercase, no spaces, and the number is numeric, not alphabetic. You can also find additional content at falfaproject.org and even sign up for our mailing list there. Please send us your emails to podcast@falfaproject.org. It might end up in an upcoming episode. But most importantly, let there be freedom and liberty for all!